I wish I was 50 years younger and I'd kick your ass.
You need to be more like a dog. We don't need a bunch of cats in here looking in the mirror. Be a dog.
Whatever happens in Leash, it's always a scandal.
Why do you think that was?
Probably because we're always drinking and stuff.
Tomás O'Shea one day and he said, I'm sick of that Northern crowd. He said if they went set dancing twice a week, we'd all be set dancing twice a week.
He said he was a plumber. I said, look, I really haven't a clue about plumbing. I won't try to tell you how to plumb.
No, I wouldn't be entitling myself up. I wouldn't be sitting in the room bashing my head off the wall or jumping up and down and slapping myself on the back or anything.
Every man, woman and monkey in Mayor is very right in the
mind. Take the buffet!
All right, a very good afternoon to you. Welcome along to our Saturday panel this week. We have with us Andy Lee, the former WBO middleweight champion of the world, Carl Pendred, now retired UFC fighter, and Tommy Martin, TV3 sports host extraordinaire. Lads, you're all very welcome. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Chair.
We were chatting a little bit earlier about getting sick, and it's grand for us. You call in sick, somebody else does the show. If you guys get sick, you miss a fight or you miss a training session, you miss a period of time preparation for a fight, and then suddenly you're not properly prepared and potential for you to lose. Like, what do you, how do you just not get sick, and do you just get sick and put fights off? Or
I know myself, when I was training and preparing for fights, I did find that I would get sick less just because of my healthy lifestyle. Like, I found I've been sick a few times now since I retired because I'm having the odd pint here and there, maybe a bit more chocolate at the weekends. But when you are healthy, you get sick less. But it does happen to, we are human and we get sick every now and again.
Would you get the flu jab every year? Like, are you allowed to get the, I presume you are.
I presume you are. And I've never got the flu jab now myself, but I'd usually get a bit of a flu once a year, but it does affect you, and you kind of, you have to force yourself to just take the foot off the gas, not turn up in the gym for a couple of days. You're going against your competitive nature, which usually wants you to turn up in the gym and train hard, but you're
trying through it,
but you're just gonna make yourself get worse, and worse at that, you could get hurt because you're not fully healthy.
Yeah, Andy, what about you? Did you ever miss anything because you were sick?
I actually had a fight. The second fight with Billy Joe was cancelled because I had a virus. And like you said, wanting to come back and probably come back to the gym too early, and then making it worse again, and then having to rest again, and then on and on and on. And the decision was taken under my hands, really, at the time. Adam, and he had informed Frank Warren, and he said, look, we're going to have to pull this because he won't be ready, and I don't want to. It was still some time out from the fight, but I didn't want to promote the fight while I was ill. And then have to cancel it later.
And was it like a serious virus, or just kind of a little few degrees under, so you're not able to train?
Yeah, I was just, you know, in bed, laid up, aching and pain and sweating, and then more or less like a flu, you know.
Yeah.
And then just had to take it. Like, the thing is, you know, go to the gym, sweat it out. That's what you think, but it's not a good idea. You know, it never is a good idea.
Yeah, that's historical advice as opposed to up-to-the-minute bleeding scientific advice. A couple of quick texts and tweets about this one. I read this one out a little bit earlier. Mick Foley, the Sunday Times writer, was saying that he knows of a few players who like to have a light cold the week before an All-Ireland final. They feel their bodies are at the limit. Go figure. And then Des Dillon has been in touch on Twitter to say, our immune system strengthens during stress and pressure. We get sick when we relax, for example, a week off work, or sick when you retire, for example.
Yeah, usually when I, after fights, like you say, when you just take off and you're eating junk food, you get cold sores, your body just breaks down because you know somewhere subconsciously you can relax.
Yeah.
You can afford to get sick. And that's usually after fights I always get sick.
You guys do take your body to the absolute limit of human preparation, though, for these fights. Like, to make the weight, you kind of ruin yourselves in a way. Like, you get to a point where you're shriveled examples of who you are 12 hours later, even. That must be kind of difficult to get used to.
Yeah, it's a learning process. The weight cutting process is something that's, you know, most fighters would see it as the hardest part of the whole journey of being a fighter.
What weight did you fight at?
I fought at 77 kilos. And, you know, I'm over 90 kilos now, and most of the time I would be around the 90 mark, so I'm coming down a good bit of weight. The first part of it is just through training. You're getting your body fat as low as possible just through diet and training. But then, you know, it's the last few kilos. I would say approximately a stone comes off in a week, which would be water weight, and you put that back on.
Without being an expert on what's going on there physiologically, that can't be healthy, or it sounds incredibly unhealthy to your body.
It's not incredibly healthy at all, to be honest. It's something fighters do, and you know, thinking, reflecting back on it, I nearly wish that it wasn't part of it. It would be nicer to be able to just show up and weigh in at your normal weight and then fight the next day at the same weight. But you're kind of forced to do it, I suppose, because everyone is doing it. If you don't do it, you're going to be at a disadvantage because you're going to be fighting a guy who's a good bit heavier than you.
In a weird way, that was never the intention of any combat sport. Historically, we didn't have the science to allow people to balloon down and balloon up. I'd say it kind of came in, I don't know, maybe you guys probably know a bit more about this, maybe in the 50s or 60s, the science started to get a bit better about that kind of stuff. Whereas, you know, in previous generations, they would have shown up, fought at their weights and gone...
Well, the weigh-in used to be the day of the fight. Historically, and so there was no chance, you know, you'd weigh in a few hours, so you had to be the weight. But they started bringing it in because people were still dehydrating on the day of the fight, you know,
to make the weight,
yeah,
and then they were dying,
and then
night.
They were going into the ring and it wasn't
so. And on that, like the Kid Chocolate fight, the Quillen fight, he didn't make the weight. Like when I heard that, I remember thinking, I just couldn't believe that. Is it a tricky thing to do? Like, is it a very precise, and if anything goes a little bit wrong, can it?
Yeah, it can be. Some guys are just, you know, they outgrow their weight, and it's unrealistic. And you know, they're the champion, or they've signed to fight a fight. They're the champion of that weight, but they're just outgrown it or whatever. But with that fight, I believe, and he didn't want to make the weight. It was his intention not to make the weight because. It's a long story, but with the, you know, PBC thing and Al Heyman, they didn't want to have the ranking bodies involved. They don't want to have the belts involved. They eventually want to create their own sanctioning body. And so it seems like since then, a lot of the PBC fights have been non-title fights, or the champion doesn't make the weight, or vice versa.
Right.
Yeah.
Because you made the point, I think, that he had like a small amount of weight to make, which a couple of hours in the sauna or whatever would have been able to do.
2 pounds, which is a kilo, and he could have done it, you know. But... even like the week of the fight, you know, Carl will tell you, like, we were doing the press conference and things like that. Everybody else, like me and the other fighters are involved. You could see we're all like drawn out, and you know, our ears are a little bit bigger and jaws are sunken in. But he just looked fine. He didn't look dry. You know, I mean, we're all like
hamburger.
Licking our lips, and he's, you know, up at the buffet. You know.
How are you getting
extra
on?
Extra slice of cheesecake.
Andy, what's how's life?
Yeah, things are good. You know, I lost a close fight to a good young fighter, and night I didn't really box well, but there's still good opportunities out there for me. I haven't really spoke to Adam, my coach, and I haven't really thought about it too much. Just been enjoying time off and being at home with my wife. Recently had a trip to America for a holiday, so yeah, just taking it easy. And there is opportunities out there for me. I'm still a big name in the middleweight division, so I'll wait and see what happens.
We had Pascal Collins on the show, I think, after the Eubank Jr. Spike O'Sullivan fight, and he was saying that he thinks that you could easily fight at super middleweight, and there's a lot of opportunity for you at that weight. Is that something of interest to you down the line when we're talking about making weight?
Not really yet. Like, I do make the weight comfortably, you know, normal standards, you know. I'm not like my weight cut would probably be 6 pounds, you know. So that's not like a lot to go up to a super middleweight. I'd have to be coming down from, you know, way higher, and I would be at a disadvantage fighting those bigger guys. Even though I have the height for it, I could probably grow into it, a bit of muscle. But you know, I'm a middleweight, and I like the middleweight division. It's a classic division, and that's where I want to be.
Yeah, I watched the third round again today. Have you watched the fight back since?
No.
See, the thing is, you caught him sweet. There's only a minute and a half left in it, and you'd actually landed a big punch, and he just turns around and pings you with the right hand.
Yeah. The thing is, I've thought about it in my mind, but I haven't watched it. And I know it's hard to say, and I don't really want to sound like, I don't want to sound bad, but in a way, I knock myself down in a way, because punching so hard, like when you're punching so hard, maybe, like, you leave yourself exposed, and if you get caught in that moment, which he did, he timed it perfect, it kind of doubled the impact of his punch, which wasn't a big punch, was just like similar like to a jab, kind of right cross. And you know, I was winging a big right hook, which has saved me, and in this fight it was my downfall, you know. But it's one of those things, and you know, it was a bad mistake to make. And as me and Martin were saying outside, it's something I've learned before, and something, you know, I learned from before. But when you're in a fight, and it's purely instinctive, and you can make a second, you know, make a decision in a second that will make or break. You know, the fights are won in those moments, split seconds, and you know, could have been me landing the punch and knocking him out, or like he dropped me and I had to fight my way back into the fight.
The encouragement to make that punch might even have come from the fact that you landed one fairly similar just before that.
Yeah, power, like it's an addictive thing when you're punching with power. You know, it's you just want it, like it can be as much as a downfall, because you can just always rely on it, you know, go back to it and forget, get away from what the boxing that got you there in the first place.
So, yeah,
like you just have to live with it. It was a bad mistake and one that I'll have to learn from. And
the fact that you finished the fight, though, presumably the fact that you get out of that round, because he knocked you down again, and it's funny because the bit in between this first and second knockdowns, you actually land another couple of punches, and it's like, wow, these guys are at it here for seconds, and then the second one just happens again, which struck me as like, you know, you didn't just decide to cover up. And
yeah, well, I've probably, again, another split second decision where I should have probably just held on and covered up, but I wanted to show him that there was still a threat there, and that, yeah, you know, when a guy's throwing punches at you, that's the best time to catch them, as like he caught me, you know? So I didn't, you know, I wanted to show him, I should have just held on, and then it would have been maybe one knockdown and got out of the round, one knockdown, and then only 1 point down.
Yeah.
Whereas now I was going into the fight with 3 points down, having lost the round as well. So it was always an uphill struggle from then.
Yeah, and yet one judge did give the fight a draw, and there was only a couple of points from in another one. So in a way, does that actually make it a bit more sickening that you managed to get back into it? Or is that like, look, that's what I'm going to use now as my springboard forward? No,
the most sickening part is that it's a guy that I expected to beat, and I fully thought I was going to beat him. Like, I should have beat him. But I didn't perform well, and those two mistakes cost me the fight, and that's the most sickening part. But I just have to live with it and get on with it, and you know, just get back on the horse and move forward.
Yeah, there's no talk of retirement. You're not thinking about that at all?
No, not yet. No, I wouldn't like to end my career on that note anyway, that's for sure.
Yeah. So any possibility of a rematch with that?
No, we've inquired about a rematch, and under no, like, he was the number one contender, so a mandatory challenger, so there was no rematch clause, like there wasn't a voluntary defense, so okay. He doesn't want it, and I can understand that, but like that says enough in itself that, you know, he got away with it. And like, and you can see the fight in the last few rounds, he was boxing in his shell and didn't want to mix or trade. He just knew he had the fight won off those two knockdowns, and that was it.
Also, pre-fight, he's like, no way am I ever fighting Gennady Golovkin. What are you, I'm not stupid. I'm not going to fight this guy who you were already set up to fight previously, and you'd agreed to fight him. So it's not exactly the ideal candidate to be a middleweight champion of the world. It looks like he's going to fight Eubank Jr. next. And there's talk that Golovkin will fight the winner of that, but, you know, he could easily back out of that too. So do you look for one of those fights? Do you look for Eubank Jr. or somebody like that? Or
no,
do you...
no, there's a good chance I could fight Danny Jacobs, the American who has a WBA belt. And maybe Peter Quillen, maybe a rematch with him,
right.
which I'd like to do, because I think there's unfinished business there. So I'll just wait and see. Like I said, I'm not putting too much thought into it. Just wait and see.
Like 6 months kind of let the
body heal? No, a couple of months, yeah. Yeah, I've had a month, and another month maybe, and then get back in the gym properly.
Yeah. Carl, you retired.
Yeah.
How's that working out? Are you delighted? I'm finished from this. You're no more cutting weight, having chocolate and drinking pints.
Yeah, I'm enjoying it. You know, I was just saying to the lads there, I was talking to a few of my friends who have retired from other sports, rugby and such, and they were asking me how we're getting on, because they found it quite difficult when they just first stepped away, because, you know, they were trying to decide what they were going to do with themselves. But seeing as I stepped away with a few things already, you know, in the pipeline, I've kept myself busy and very happy with the choice. I'm still training every day. I think I'll continue to do that for as long as I can.
Are you working on health food? Is that right?
Yeah. I'm opening up. There's a chain of healthy food restaurants called Chopped, and I'm opening up one of those soon.
How did you get into that? Was it something you'd always, like, you know, you decided that you were going to be a professional fighter, and you went, one of the things I need to learn about here is nutrition. Was it that way, or were you kind of always interested in it?
Well, nutrition obviously was something I learned because of what I was doing. I did a bit of nutrition in college as well, so I had a really good understanding of it. But it was just something I had to do. I had to eat healthy because I was a fighter, and I, you know, found it was difficult when you're out and about to get something healthy, something that's not a chicken fillet roll or a crisp sandwich, you know. There was no, like, fast food that was healthy. So it was something I decided I wanted to do. And when I first thought I wanted to do it, I was going to do it myself. You know, set up Pendred Health Healthy Restaurant or something.
Catchy but, name.
But I just can't. I actually just happened to meet one of the owners of Chop, Brian Lee. He was training with a mutual friend, and we ended up training together one day doing some jiu-jitsu. So we met in the mats, and I actually just said to him, I'm thinking of opening up a healthy food place. I knew he owned Chopped, would I be able to have a sit down with him and pick his brain at some stage? And he said, well, funny enough, we're just turning Chopped into a franchise, so if you want to chat to me about that, I'd be happy to do so. And the more I thought about it, and the more I chatted to him, I realised that was the best way to go about it.
Was this after you'd retired? No,
this was well over a year ago. So, you know, I'd been planning that for a while, and I'm getting the ball rolling for a while, and just ready to pull the trigger now.
Did you know your retirement was imminent? Like, did you kind of have a sense, okay, I'm going to be able to do this a couple more times? Because your fights are brutal.
I always planned on retiring early-ish. You know, you see fighters that go on to their late 30s. And it's nearly a pride thing, and they go too far, too long and too far. And it was always my plan to retire early, but not this early. I just felt the push of a fight, what it involved. I just wasn't in love with doing it anymore. So
why not? It's a matter of interest. What was it? What were the things that made you think, I used to love doing this? I got up every morning thinking I'm going to be able to do this for a long time, and then suddenly it's like
getting punched in the face.
Well, I'm still getting punched in the face. I just think it's your whole I'm in more in control.
That health food is getting very dangerous these days. <Scott. laughs>
I'm more in control of my life now. I decide I can train when I want to train. If I want to go on a holiday, I can pick when I want to go on a holiday. When you're a fighter, I think, you know, everything in your life is dictated around when you fight, and you know, especially in the UFC, you're kind of fighting when and where you're told. There's not much. You're not really brought into the equation yourself. So I think it was just that was the main reason. I just wanted control of my life again.
Yeah, the UFC doesn't really seem to respect their fighters very much unless you are one of their absolute superstars. Like, they don't pay very well for a start. There's no union, there's no real healthcare. I mean, you get some healthcare, some health insurance around the fights. It seems like they hold all the power.
Yeah, they definitely hold most of the cards. All right, it is frustrating being a fighter. I think there are some things getting better, but they're definitely. The main problem is they have a monopoly on in the business. There's no one that's even comes close to them in terms of competition for them. So it's realistically for a fighter, it's the only place you can really make some sort of a living. So
yeah, we had Aljamain Sterling on the show, and he is a featherweight. Granted, so it's not the most high profile of weight divisions, but he was getting an offer of $20,000 a fight and $20,000 to win. And he was only two or three fights away from having a fight for a belt. And they were offering him $3,000 extra per fight as he got there. He was going to be $26,000 for a title fight and $26,000 to win. And you're like, that's going to be one of the main fights on a big card.
Yeah, I think the UFC's monopoly is both its strength in terms of its growth in recent years, but also its weakness in terms of looking after their fighters. As you say, it is a classic monopoly. It's like the old steel mill in the Industrial Revolution town. People had to take whatever wages they were paid because there was nowhere else to get a job. But in terms of promoting the fighters and promoting the fights, like, I think it's something you see with Andy in terms of the rival promoters and the deals. And you know we were talking a bit off air between all the lawsuits and everything that goes on that makes it hard to set up a fight and a big promotion in boxing. UFC, it's so controlled and so brilliantly, slickly marketed. Everything from the staging of the fights to the media around them. You know, they have the pay-per-view, but they also have free-to-air. They have Vines. They have online content fired out there, and they know how to market and promote their product, so it works for them, but it doesn't necessarily work for the fighters in terms of their welfare.
Yeah, definitely. Like, in terms of marketing and promotion, I think there's a lot of companies and you know, sports leagues that could take after the UFC. They are incredible at promoting and marketing themselves. It would be great to see they'll maybe promote and market some more of the young and up and coming talent, not only for the talent's sake, but also for the UFC's sake. I mean, they could be promoting the next Conor McGregor or, you know, the next Anderson Silva. So maybe take a bit more of a gamble on that. I think it would be great for the fighters. And it will work out for in everyone's interest.
Andy, what's life like as a fighter these days? Because for a long time, you know, you would have wanted title fights and couldn't get them, and then you were getting title fights. But there was a long period there where it didn't look like it was going to happen for you. In retrospect, is there anything that a fighter can do to change that for themselves? Like, do you just need to trash talk a bit more?
Yeah, well, I think it does help, you know. It does help you get more record. Like, in this day and age, and especially in this part of the world, like in England and Ireland and stuff, when in the boxing scene, it seems like the fight has to have that sort of element to for people to be interested. Like, it almost has to be like a soap opera. You know, people want to tune in and get the video on YouTube where, like, oh, he said this at the weigh-in, he said this at the press conference, and did you see this and this, and he did this antic, and everyone's coming up with new ideas to be, like, flamboyant or be, like, you know, outrageous. So, for me, like, it's never been my style, you know. It's never been, I suffered because I didn't talk, you know, smack or whatever. I just represented myself and been myself. But, like, to me, I don't really like, in boxing, I don't like it, you know, too much, you know. Even though it's a tried and tested formula, you know, yeah. talk loud, back it up in the ring, or as Conor, no, back it up in the octagon and the cage. And next thing, you know, it does, it is trying, like, from the days of Muhammad Ali, even before him, you know, it's been a tried and tested formula. Be brash, be loud, and back it up in the ring, and you'll get, you know, you'll turn heads.
But I don't think you can do it if it's not in you, though. Yeah, I think people see through if
it comes through. It comes through, you know.
If you're putting it on.
Yeah.
There's nothing worse than a bad shtick, is there?
Yeah. And I think Andy, you know, without, you know, blowing smoke up your arse, Andy, I think you've been such a classy individual over the last couple of years of your career. Like, anybody who's dealt with you in the media would agree with that. But also, you know, I would have thought you were, you know, incredibly marketable for your personality, which is, as you say, is not put on. It's completely natural, but it's, you know, you're an intelligent, classy guy, but you're also a great fighter, and you know, and some of the best fights to watch over the last couple of years have been yours. And that's what I say when I was talking about the UFC maybe being better at marketing, you know, a brand of a fighter. Like, I mean, I would have thought, and it annoys me that in Ireland, I don't know if we valued or appreciated Andy as much as we should have. And my bugbear of that is that we didn't see enough of him on Saturday night on free-to-air TV, or, you know, where the nation gathered around and watched one of Andy's fights. That didn't happen enough. It happened for Bernard Dunn, and, you know, he became a household name out of it. Like, Andy, you know, deserved every house in Ireland, you know, should have seen Andy win those big fights.
Yeah. I think possibly part of that is that the UFC are invested in the individual fighters, whereas the fighters themselves in boxing have to run their own marketing campaign. You know, you've got to be a lawyer, you've got to be a psychologist, you've got to be a financial advisor to all the people who are working for you as well. It's a much more self-centered position. Like, maybe if you'd signed with a different promoter and stuck with one promoter over the years, I don't know. Maybe that's the worst thing to do.
Yeah, it's just the way it is, and just who I am. I know, it's just the way that the cards fell, you know. I'm not, I don't have any gripes about it. I'm very happy with what I achieved. And,
sure.
And you know, the level of success or fame, whatever it is, that I have. So, I'm very content, you know. No, I'm not worried about it.
Andy Lee should be on the front, on cereal boxes in Ireland.
Do you think the sport of boxing would benefit if, say, there was, like the UFC, there was one promotion and the majority of fighters were under that banner?
Well, I touched on earlier what this PBC Al Haymon thing. That's what they're trying to achieve. You know, he's the head honcho, and they eventually want to start their own belt, their own organization, and it's on terrestrial TV in America. So that's the way it's going. Whether that can be successful or not, going up against the old powers that are there, you know, the top ranks, the Golden Boys and HBO and, you know, Showtime. So there's already a number of lawsuits against the PBC Al Haymon thing. So, you know, you just have to just wait and see. It's different time in boxing, you know. It's not, but maybe it's a good thing. Like, you know, people, they're trying something new doesn't mean it's bad.
No, definitely. Yeah. It's, and it might be more opportunity for fighters to have bigger fights.
You know, they're paying everybody well, and from my experience, it was a good experience with them. You know, they were good to deal with. And one of the good things about it, they in their contract, you have to be tested, randomly tested, which is not always the case. So, like,
well, look, you both have this incredible shared history of fighting fighters who were clearly off their heads on something. Like the Julio Cesar Chavez Jr. fight is, and the, what happens in the aftermath is an absolute travesty of justice in boxing. And I think, was it two fighters that you fought against both tested positive afterwards?
Yeah. Wow. And that's only that I know of, because you know, before I got to the UFC, we weren't tested at all. And you just don't really know. And, you know, it's something I take away with me. Having retired now is something, you know, I always kept my integrity. You can see, being a competitor, you can see why people do take steroids. As an athlete, you want to get every advantage possible. You know, you're getting, making sure you get as much sleep. You're eating completely right. Anything that can give you 1% advantage, you will do. But when it comes to certain people, they'll take those advantages as long as they're legal. And myself and Andy would be athletes like that.
You see it though, like, what? Because normal human beings might see it and go, "Fuck this! This game is skewed. I'm doing what everybody else does when the game is skewed. I'm skewing the game back in my favor." How do you not do that?
That's the excuse everyone uses, and I think that's why everyone starts to take stuff, is because, you know, they say to themselves, "Well, everyone is doing it." I don't think that's true sometimes, though. Yeah, I think there is, you know, probably a majority of them. But I don't think.
Did you ever have that conversation with yourself? Like, was it a realistic thing, or were you just like, my values don't even allow me to consider, okay, so you're a cheat, that's fine, we're going to get on with this, I don't care?
Yeah, no, I never even considered it as an option of doing. I just, you know, I knew there was people I was speculating before I even fought them that they were taking it, and, you know, the results showed with the test afterwards they were. But I just, you know, I just kept my integrity. I would have felt like I was cheating myself, and I just didn't want to do it.
Yeah. Why did you know they were? How did you know they were? What was it? What was the giveaway?
One guy in particular, I was fighting in Mexico, and I had to fly to Mexico. The UFC flew me out for a media thing, and he was extremely heavy prior to this, and I figured there was no way he could naturally shed that weight. We were fighting maybe in 5 weeks, 4 or 5 weeks' time. I figured there was no way he could shed that weight in 4 or 5 weeks' time.
Lo and behold, magically, here he goes.
And
he's skinning links.
And then a month after the fight, it came out that he'd been taking some sort of steroid.
Yeah. What would be your sense of the UFC dope testing rigorousness?
It was pretty brutal or useless even to say at the start, because you were only getting tested on fight night. So, for anyone that would be, you know how to take steroids, they would know when to stop taking it. So
out of competition testing
wasn't there, and the main benefits of steroids would be throughout your training camp. That's where a fight is won or lost. That's where the hard work goes into it, and that's where a fighter would need steroids, you know, to get that second or third training session in a day when they're feeling tired. So if guys are taking stuff up until 2 or 3 weeks before the fight, and then they stop and they know, well, it won't show up then. That's when they were doing that, there was definitely a lot of guys taking it and they wouldn't have got caught. But now there's random drug tests, and the UFC are using USADA, the anti-doping agency over in the US, and they're calling fighters' doors at 6 a.m. in the morning and looking for urine samples. So a lot of guys have been caught in the last couple of months since they started using that.
Even USADA's record in boxing is shaky enough. There was an amazing piece by Thomas Hauser about the build-up to the Mayweather-Pacquiao fight, and they turned the drug testing on. So if you're a fighter, USADA are only engaged for a period of time in which you're fighting, i.e. a short window before the fight. So for the 6 weeks before that, you could be dope, get out of your system. Now officially you've signed the contracts, now USADA are coming in, they test you, and like, oh look, I'm clean. Particularly around the Mayweather stuff, if you want to look up that Thomas Hauser piece, it's really good. So it's funny you mentioned that. It's interesting that's one of the things that you have faith in this organisation, because they're bringing it to you, Andy. Is that because of your experience? You think, hang on, this isn't fair, I'm getting cheated here?
No, like, when there's so much money involved, you know, it's, you can see why guys try to go for it, you know, like, and why everyone knows, like, even like the promoters know what they're doing, or the trainers know, because they're all benefiting from it, you know. It is disheartening, but like you say, you have to be, you know, integrity and holding your own head high and looking yourself in the mirror at the end of the day, and what that means to you, you know. But like, you know, we're in a good place in terms of sport in general. Like, you know, you got Russia and the athletics, and you got cycling, and you know what I mean, it's just, it's coming, and now tennis matches being like, at least it's coming to the front, even though you're probably saying like, wow, everything's rigged, but
it is coming,
so at least people have become more aware of it, and it's coming to light.
Yeah, there's work being done that we can trust to expose this.
Something I've always felt as well is you have to take it more personally in the fight game when you're competing against someone who's using steroids, because they're putting your health you know, in jeopardy. If they're taking something, they're stronger, fitter, faster, and you know, it's your health. It's not like a cyclist or you know, a sprinter, where it doesn't directly affect your competitors in that sense. It does directly affect the fighter, because you're going in there and feeling that artificial power, so to speak.
It's one thing, running against somebody who's on steroids, they're running away from you, but a fighter is running towards you.
Exactly,
I mean, you would think that punishment should be even more severe in fight sports for that reason.
I think so. I think it should nearly be a criminal offence, to be honest.
Yeah, some countries are trying to make it criminal. I think the Germans were talking about doing it, but certainly in the fight game, where your aim is to concuss your opponent to knock them out. If you're doing that and you do it too hard, then the consequences are absolutely dire for people. 53106 is the text number. If you want to get in touch with us, you can tweet us here at Off the Ball. Kieran and Athlone says, great to hear Andy is planning on fighting again. It must be incredibly difficult to get back in the ring. What does Andy think of Conor McGregor? Always been impressed by how Andy handles himself in public. Can't say the same about McGregor, says Carl and Wicklow, who's obviously in the anti-McGregor camp. What do you make of what McGregor's done?
I really like him. I think, like I said earlier, it's a tried and tested formula. He's speaking big, he's talking big, he's living it up. And he's backing it up in the ring. And you can't, like, when you see knocking out Jose Aldo in 13 seconds, you have to give him credit. You know what I mean? That's a sensational performance.
Yeah.
And he's backing everything up he said, so why not, you know?
It's one of the most explosive performances in Irish sports history. I'm sure he thought he was going to do it, but I'd say the rest of the world kind of thought that it might be. This could easily go 3 rounds, this could easily go 5 rounds. I don't think anybody predicted 13 seconds.
No, definitely not, especially with how long Aldo had been at the top of that division, 10 years. He was unbeaten, and he was UFC champion or world champion for 5 or 6 years. So I don't think anyone saw it that way except Conor. But when you're around Conor and he's telling you he's going to do something, it's hard to doubt the guy.
You obviously have been part of the vanguard of the evolution of UFC into the mainstream in Ireland. And just as it gets massive, you're like, okay, I'm finished now. Is there like any kind of regrets that you're not just coming now and it's like, hey, look, I'm the latest Irish fighter?
No, I feel very privileged that I was I was within the sport when I kind of went through this transition. When I first got into the sport, when I first turned professional, you couldn't get an inch in a tabloid newspaper about us, and if you did, it was usually in a bad light. And it just was this transition over a few years of the public not being aware of the sport to everyone being crazy about it, and I that's something that I'll always look back fondly on, was being a part of that transition or that period when it went from absolute obscurity to mainstream.
Yeah, because sorry, go on.
I think it's very interesting what's happened with UFC in Ireland and you know, specifically with Conor. To me, Conor is a rock star as much as he is, you know, a sports person. I think he's tapped into something above and beyond the actual sport of UFC itself. Like, he's representing something for young Irish people. I don't know if it's certain kind of, you know, disenfranchisement or anger that the younger generation might feel, that the, you know, if you think of people under the age of 30, you know, they might have been going to school and expect to get a job out of college, and then suddenly the older generation have basically screwed up the country, you know, down to greed and you know, misgovernance and stupidity. I imagine Conor represents for a lot of people a kind of a screw you attitude that is incredibly intoxicating. And I know this because, you know, you hear people who aren't sports fans, you know, and it's just McGregor. It's McGregor. It's the confidence, and the, you know, he's not going to be even dictated to by the Dana Whites of this world. You know, he's sort of symbolic, I think, of a lot of young Irish people who just, you know, are sick of the crap that's gone on in this country,
and
you know, the last 10 years.
People are a lot more confident these days, and you know, with the influence of American TV and stuff, and they want to see that. That's what they want, someone to represent them like that, you know.
Yeah, it's a very un-Irish thing.
Yeah, it is. He's inspiring to people because there wasn't really an Irish person that carried themselves like that. I can't think of too many people that carried themselves like that, and you know, flew up through the ranks, and it didn't change them whatsoever. and he's inspiring people. And like Tommy alluded to there, he's kind of shown like you don't have to join the rat race if you don't want to, and especially with the way things have gone with the country. So there are young people looking up to him and saying, you know, there's, you don't have to choose the path that's laid out in front of you.
And also, I mean, obviously there are a lot of people who don't find UFC appealing or appetizing and find, you know, aspects of it. You know, I think, was it Paul Kimmage? I think I remember tweeting around the time saying he found it repulsive, and don't understand that this is exactly the sort of stuff people were saying about Mick Jagger in the 60s or punk in the 70s. Like, your parents hating something is exactly the reason why kids love something. So it's, you know, that's only going to make McGregor and UFC even bigger.
It is what you both did for a living is really difficult. It's brutal. Like, it's terrible being ringside and watching people who you've met in situations like this taking punches. Like, I was over at Bernard Dunn's last fight in America. It was against a Mexican in Minnesota. And the whole place emptied out because it was a co-headline, but the previous guy, can't even remember who it was now, he was actually quite famous, but had been the local guy who'd been beaten, and so the whole crowd left, and coming out into a fairly empty stadium, and the Mexican walks out and headbutts him in the forehead, smacks him in the first 10 seconds, the referee goes, Jesus, and the fight goes on, and you're like, this is brutal, and it went the full distance, and afterwards we went to the hospital with him, and he's just sitting there, and it's like, this is one of the hardest ways that anybody makes a living. And that's the brutality. It's like, it's difficult. It's a really difficult thing that you guys do. And I'm squeamish a little bit about it, I have to say, just because it's hard work.
And that's why it's something you have to be very passionate about. You can only do, it is very hard. It's a tough graft. And you can only do that successfully when you're really, really passionate about it. And I was for so long so passionate about it. And that's what I would attribute to my success to.
The aftermath of the fights, right, when you're that physically broken, how long does it take you to feel normal again? Or do you just get used to living with pain in some element that...
Yeah, I mean, the next day or two, depending on the type of fight you had, usually I had, you know, fairly brutal fights, so you'd be sore for maybe 3 or 4 days, but that was
really
that, yeah,
because it looks like you're going to be sore for the next 6 months after.
Not really, like a lot of the stuff is superficial. You get black eyes and stuff, but that, you know, they look bad, but you're not physically in pain too much from black eyes and stuff.
What about you, Andy, after the
it's a hard game, but you know, getting up every day and going to work, a 9-to-5 job is a hard game too, you know. Like, we're training for an intense period, and then we're off, and we can have 2 or 3 weeks of relaxing now, doing what we want. And then as well, on the upside, you get all that glory, you know, get to beat another man physically, and then have your hand raised. There's no better feeling. So, listen, you take the good with the bad, and I wouldn't change it. I wouldn't do, even if I retired today, I wouldn't know what I want to do. So all I know is fighting, and I still want to fight.
It's interesting that Carl was developing something in the background. So at some point, are you going to start developing something in the background? I think
I don't even want to allow myself to have those
thoughts. Your heart sank even with the question. Yeah.
So for now, my mind's on boxing.
What do Andy and Carl think of the quality of boxing in the UFC? Siri, Holly Holm and McGregor all have good boxing, but otherwise I think myself there may be a lack of top class striking in the UFC, says Mark.
I Carl would be more of an authority, but from what I see, it seems the ones who can punch better, who can strike better, they're more successful, you know. Holly Holm was a very good boxer herself, you know, when she boxed, and Conor McGregor, you can see he boxed himself, so you can see he has technique. I think there'd be a good avenue for boxing coaches, for UFC fighters to bring in boxing coaches, and if they want to work on that, you know.
Yeah, you have to be good at everything.
I know you worked with Igor, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. I worked with Igor. Boxing was something, you know, it was something that I didn't have a background in, so it was something I was always trying to get better at. But you definitely, to be at the top of the game, you have to be great at everything, and boxing was one of those things. It's slightly different in terms of the way you strike in MMA compared to boxing. I mean, you're standing further apart, you know, with the exchanges, there wouldn't be as many combinations, and there might be a bit more time in between the combinations as well. So it is
smaller gloves, and you know, you can't take a risk with those gloves on. But I just assume it's like a fist fight, because you know, you see a fist fight, it's two guys standing back a lot. Yeah. No one's taking a chance. They're not until the perfect moment, and it's the same. You know, it's the same with those gloves, because if you expose yourself, i.e., Jose Aldo, you're gone.
Exactly.
Yeah, where boxing is slightly bigger gloves.
To protect yourself, you mean?
You can block them a little bit more, and the absorption is a little bit easier.
You talked about being addicted to power a little while ago. When did that happen to you?
I think it's more part of my the way I'm training now. It's a lot more athletic, as we've spoken before. The move to Adam Booth and the way he trains and the technique that he teaches, which took me a long time to learn. It is, you know, my, like everyone knows, my right hook is the punch, and it's. I can punch extreme when I'm training and I'm fit and I'm working. I can punch very, very hard, and I don't know when it happened, but it is. It's addictive, and it's as much as it's a boon, it's a downfall. You know, it's not
an everyday toy.
No, it's not. It's good, and it has good and bad points. And the bad points is that you can rely on it too much, and it can leave you exposed. I.e., Quillen knocking me down the first time, and now Billy Joe Saunders, who's not considered a big puncher, knocking me down, you know, which was the funny thing about the fight was he was known as a better boxer and I was known as a puncher, and he ended up knocking me down. I ended up boxing him for seven of the, you know, round more. I boxed him more rounds, but he had the knockdowns.
The Brian Vera fight, the first one where you lost, it's clearly a turning point in your career, in that you know you regrouped, you regathered, you became obsessed about kind of learning from it. Mm. Are you in a similar level of obsession at the moment about this?
No, I, you know, with experience, I'm not beating myself. Like that fight really was a tough blow to take because of where I was at the time and how young I was. But you know, it hurts me. I can't sleep at night without listening to a podcast or something, because if any moment alone I'm thinking about the fight. You know, it does hurt when you lose a fight, but. That's just how it is. I did lose the fight, and that's it. I have to live with it and come back from it, and it'll be testament to me if I can regain the title.
But you know that goes away at some point too, that pain goes away, because this is, you've been through, like,
yeah,
you're,
I know,
professional,
yeah,
sports people, you're going to lose. That's
sport and life, you know, that's the way it is. Yeah,
it's worse as a fighter though, isn't it? I mean, it's not like you're going out there with, as part of a rugby team or something, and you lose. You all lose together collectively. Mm-hmm. When you go out there and you're a fighter, when you lose, you're taking all of that yourself,
and it's like for that period of time, it's anybody you meet, it's all they want to talk about. You know what I mean? So you're reliving the whole thing again. I.e., me being here.
Does it help? Like, does it help to talk? Sorry, you on the couch here, but
nah, no. I don't. It doesn't. No, I just don't want to talk about it at all. I just want to, like, as soon as someone says something about it, I'm just trying to distance myself from it straight away.
The only way you can get over it is to get out there again and win. You're always, I think, as a fighter, your life always is based on your last fight. And one of the other part of, you know, another problem with being a fighter is that you don't fight that often. It's not like another sport like football or rugby where you're playing every week. It's months in between, and you got to live with that in between.
Other sports, you get a chance to redeem yourself.
Yeah. Andy used the word there. It's about the glory. You know, the glory of standing there with your hand raised. It's a primal thing. It goes back to, you know, the, you know, ancient times. Like, there's always been man against man, and, you know, the glory of winning it there. You know, it's I presume it's intoxicating.
Yeah, that's why people can relate to fighting sports or boxing or UFC, because it's somewhere inside them there's that fight, you know.
Mm.
Andy says he's addicted to power. Were you addicted to training? Like, at some point, are you thinking, what got you into this?
Yeah, I was just addicted to the whole, I suppose, the discipline, the lifestyle of it. You know, when I was just in love with it, I was just addicted to the whole thing, the glory.
Do you remember the first time you fought, like, in a fight that you trained for?
Mm. Yeah, I can remember my whole career, like, in detail, to be honest. I loved every moment of it, and I wouldn't take it back for anything. It was an amazing experience.
And was your route in MMA immediately? Because a lot of people get in through one of the other, like, some people are jiu-jitsu, some people do taekwondo, and then they kind of realize, actually, hang on, I can marry that skills, or I'm not going to be world class in this, I could try this. Were you straight MMA straight away?
Yeah, I'd done different bits of martial arts when I was a kid, but nothing for more than a few months. My parents used to hate when I'd come up to them after school and say, oh, I want to do this martial art now, because they knew they'd buy me all the gear and I'd be doing it for a few months and then I'd stop and there'd be another thing. So I never really had a background in anything in particular, and I was just a fan of it as a teenager. It used to be on one of the satellite channels, and I used to watch it. And then when I left school, I was over in America and came across a gym, and I'd always wanted to try it out. I said I'd give it a go. And
were you just on a J1 in the States?
Yeah, just living over in San Diego, and there was loads of gyms over there in California, and took it up, and I was addicted to it from the start.
Did you have your first fight over there? Or?
No, no. I only took it up at a few classes. I could barely afford to train over there too much anyway, because most of your money was spent on beer while you were over in the gym. So I just did a few classes. But then when I came home, I was determined to keep it up. And I didn't know there was anywhere here to do it, but I started researching and Googling things, and I found there was actually a scene here. It was very underground. There was no... There was no spotlight on it whatsoever, but I found there was gyms, and I took it up. And
you were playing rugby simultaneously?
Yeah, I was playing
around that.
I was playing under 20s for Clontarf at the time. And
did you find that the rugby wasn't ticking a box for you that the MMA was? You know, was there just something that, no, this is actually...
Yeah, it just had more for me that what I was looking for. I mean, I always was involved in sports because I was a competitor, but I just found what MMA had as opposed to rugby was more what I was looking for in terms of the one-on-one competition. Yeah. I my favourite thing about the rugby was the physicality part of it. Like, I wasn't too interested in holding the ball or running down the wing. I was more interested in making tackles and stuff. So it was like MMA was just a more concentrated form of what I was looking for in sport.
You kind of both have to like getting punched, because you're volunteering for it a lot, right? At some point, there's something inside you that goes, that was a good punch, actually. Yeah, you know, I respect you for doing that to me.
I was talking to Andy when we arrived here, and he was talking about the moment, the first punch you take in a fight, that even, you know, no matter how many fights you've had, you still have to get used to that and go, oh, he's actually punched me in the face.
Yeah, but like, you know, when you warm into a fight, it's much easier to take punches. Well, we were just talking about Conor McGregor and the Jose Aldo. The first punch is always the most difficult one. You know, Emmanuel Stewart always would say, make sure you try and knock him out in the first 30 seconds. Or just try him, at least try him once, you know, because the guy is not used to, like, the person's not used to absorbing punches.
Anything can happen in the first round.
Yeah, and they take it. So you'd see a lot in the first round knockouts. That's why, because the guy is cold, he's not warmed up properly, or he's gotten cold as he got to the ring, and you can take him out.
Yeah, but at some point you kind of enjoy, okay, this sparring session is going to be good because this guy's going to catch me.
No, dude. The plan is this guy's going to be good and I'm going to make him miss. That's the plan. No, that's the way it is. You know, that's it is.
But you keep volunteering for it. It doesn't make any sense. You keep volunteering. This guy's going to continue to punch you, and it's his job. I'm paying this guy to punch me.
Yeah, it's not. It's just a given. It's just.
I think you're missing the point, chair.
Yeah. It's not like, you know, like people say, oh, do you not hate the guy? You don't. You're both going in there with a, like, there's an agreement, a silent agreement between you guys. You know, like, we're going to punch each other. We're going to try and knock each other out.
It's like saying to a golfer, you like to miss putts because, you know, they all miss putts, but it's never the aim of the game. The aim of the game is to get a hole in one. That just doesn't happen. I mean, the ideal scenario for a fight is you go in, he misses and you slip the punch and knock him out.
You do have to live with it, though. I guess the golf analogy, you're always going to have to make that a part of your consciousness, that I am going to suffer pain. And that's the thing, I think, that always separates the people who have been in combat sports from the rest of us who are like, no thanks.
You definitely build up more of a tolerance, I suppose, for pain just throughout the training. Yeah, but the most pain you feel is the stuff you put through yourself, you know, your body being tired and pushing yourself to do that extra bit more. That's the worst pain you feel as a fighter, and it's the one that gets you.
Andy was asking me before we came on air, did I ever box? And I told him about when myself and my brother is about the same, a year older, about 10 or 11, we were, you know, battering head out of each other as kids do. And Dad said, right, two of you down to the boxing club. We both looked at each other and kind of went, nah, don't fancy that.
You decided to be best friends after that.
Yeah, we never looked back.
It's a good thread.
I think it's either in you or it's not.
I didn't realise it worked. The training that you're doing now, does it fill the void? Are you happy enough?
Yeah, I feel like I'm getting what I need. It's the cheapest form of therapy anyway, you know.
Just one last question. So did you ever feel okay after a defeat, that like you had given your best and someone with superior technique or something beat you, and so I've made an accommodation with this, that there are occasions where I gave my best and I feel okay?
No, it's never the nature of a fighter to accept that. I mean, you always, you know, as a fighter and as a competitor, you're either reflecting on mistakes you made or just that you weren't yourself on the night. Like Andy said there, it's hard to sleep after a loss. It's just what you're reflecting on for so long. And the only way to get that out of your head is to get onto the next one and win. So thankfully I didn't lose too many times in my career, but when I did, there was nothing worse. It's like living a nightmare, and you're just thinking back on it the whole time, what you did wrong.
Yeah, so this isn't the best time of your life then, Andy. The last couple of weeks you've been like...
Well, we were just saying, like, you know, I won the title last year around the same time, and like, couldn't be more different start, like, two Christmases, you know. But look what I've achieved, and look what I've done, and the fighter I am, and you know, I lost a close fight to a very good young fighter, and I can always come, you know, they're still there for me. So I'm not beating myself too much. I'm not making it miserable. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm looking on the up. I'm not on the up. You know, I'm looking at the positives, and I'm ready to come back. You know, sometime this year I'll come back.
All going well. One fight this year, two fights this year, maybe?
Maybe two, yeah. Get back in there. Like I said, get to exercise the demons and then and then look up for somebody else.
There's no need for a warm-up fight or anything like that, is there, at this stage of your career?
Not necessarily. I mean, you know, I don't really need it. No, I wouldn't be looking for one. If I could get a fight with Jacobs or Quillen straight away, I'll go for it.
Yeah, because you're still ranked obviously in the top 10 in the world, and that's kind of the time to do this.
Yeah,
like, who makes those negotiations for you at this point? Is that
I'm still signed with Ludabella and Adam Booth, so
okay,
it's between those guys.
Alright, and will you get back in training at some point soon?
See how we go on. I'm enjoying
a month or two maybe.
Yeah.
Well, listen, I hope you get some better sleep sometime soon, and those hours of wakefulness or whatever podcast you're listening to are doing the business for you. Lads, thanks very much. It's been great having you with us this afternoon.
Pleasure.
And we'll talk to you again real soon. 53106 is the text number if you want to get in touch. Spurs are 2-0 up on Colchester now, and it looks like they're coasting in the FA Cup. We're going to take a quick break. We're back with loads more coming up after these.